Today on EdgeFX.
People smoke weed everywhere. They're not going to stop. They're not going to stop growing it. You have to de-incentivize it somehow. And really the main way to do that is by attacking it at the price level. We can connect price, the economic landscape, to the actual landscape, to the environment, where the fate of the coho salmon depends on the federal government's ability to smash the black market, in cannabis.
Ecologist Tim Bean speaks to historian Nick Johnson, author of the new book, Grassroots, A History of Cannabis in the American West. Their wide-ranging discussion covers the history of cannabis in the United States, guerrilla cultivation in sugar beet fields, and the environmental impacts of contemporary grow operations in the hills of Northern California and the warehouses of Denver, Colorado. The historical depth and ecological perspective they offer brings much-needed insight to the cannabis reform movement sweeping across the nation.
Hey, Nick Johnson, thanks again for joining EdgeFX, the podcast, and your new book is Grassroots, A History of Cannabis in the American West. We appreciate you joining us.
Thanks for having me.
EdgeFX seems like the perfect place to talk about this book because the EdgeFX blog and the podcast are both interested in the boundaries between things. And that's one of the things that interests me about cannabis, too, and that is kind of woven throughout your book, is the fact that cannabis straddles a bunch of different boundaries.
Right.
And so I'm hoping in this interview, we can kind of go through a few of those. A simple one to start with, explain the differences between what you call drug cannabis and hemp.
So drug cannabis is what we would is popularly known as marijuana. So it's a variety of the cannabis or varieties of the cannabis plant that produces THC, which is tetrahydrocannabinol, which is the primary psychoactive ingredient in marijuana. So all of the cannabis plants that produce that kind of just, I use that term to kind of as a catch-all because there's cannabis, that's drug cannabis that's used to produce marijuana. There's also drug cannabis that's used to produce hashish, which is just the concentrated resin scraped off of the plants. So there's kind of different, and then of course there's all these different extracts now with oils and shatter and all these things. So I just kind of use that term to kind of catch all of those definitions under one term, and then also differentiate from hemp, which is non-psychoactive varieties of cannabis that have been bred for longer fibers, and they contain very, very little trace amounts of THC.
I think it's interesting how the confusion between drug cannabis and hemp has been a problem for state and federal governments for a long time. How has the government confused these two things?
I honestly don't really blame them too much. Having researched the plant myself, there was several times when I was really sure which was which and, you know, what the plant was essentially. And then I would read something else that would be like, well, no, wait a minute, maybe it's not. And they're actually still, you know, plant geneticists are still trying to figure out how many species of cannabis there are. And so that's kind of the basic problem, is that we're dealing with a very cryptic, complex plant. But to answer your question, you know, beginning with the Marijuana Tax Act, which is when cannabis was kind of first officially defined by the government, it did not make the distinction between hemp and drug cannabis, because it was under the assumption that they both came from the same plant. Now, there was information at the time that, you know, several earlier studies, you know, from England, that you could say they had information available that would lead them to draw a different conclusion, to recognize the fact that these were, in fact, two different plants. But basically, for lack of better knowledge, there was a whole lot of fear going around at that time. The newspaper reports about people killing other people under the influence and all of that. And I know you probably want to ask about that later. So it really comes out of an incomplete knowledge of the plant. And then just kind of a basic, there was a refusal to just do the due diligence on it, and to a failure to recognize the ease with which the plant would be transported across the landscape, you know, in defiance of federal law.
Remind us, when was the Marijuana Tax Act that you're talking about passed?
1937.
And do you think it was possible? I mean, you're talking about, it's still confusing today, both in the literature, but also like in hand, you may not be able to tell the difference between drug cannabis and hemp. Do you think,
right,
were there people at the time advocating for distinguishing between the two when that act was passed?
I believe if we go back to the Tax Act hearings, I'm not sure if Woodward brought it up, but he was the one who was obviously the one who was more vocal in support of kind of a a more nuanced understanding of cannabis in the society. He's the one who actually said, no, you know, you're calling it marijuana. We should actually start calling it cannabis. That's just a scientific name. But, you know, I don't think there was anybody at the time who was really clear about that distinction. Like I said, there were reports available to the government. You know, had they been willing to do the due diligence on the plant, they would have found that, for instance, the French botanist Lamarck, back, you know, in the 18th century, he's the one who argued for cannabis indica, Indian hemp, as it came to be called. That's how drug cannabis was known in the United States, you know, as early as the 19th century. And he was the one who said, you know, that this is hemp from India is different from our European, our English hemp. So that was well known, that distinction between cannabis indica and cannabis sativa. Of course, today, you know, it's gone back and forth whether there are actually two different species with those names. Right now, the most convincing genetic evidence is that they're not different species, but they are genetically distinct. So you can just see how if it's confusing for us here in the 21st century with all the, you know, information we have available, it definitely was not clear in the mid 20th. But at the same time, there was information available that could have made for a more informed decision about cannabis policy.
So Marijuana Tax Act is passed in 1937, and just 5 years later, that failure to distinguish between drug cannabis and hemp became a problem. Talk a little more about
that. Right. So yeah, when our hemp supplies were cut off from the Philippines at the advent of World War II, the United States government started a program in 1942 called Hemp for Victory. And their goal was to basically radically expand the hemp acreage in the United States to provide a cordage for sailing vessels. And that program actually did take effect. It went from 1942 to 1943. And then it actually continued through the end of the war until it was shut down by the government again, of course, to bring it back in line with federal law. So that was an instance in which, you know, the federal government kind of ran up against its own incompetence or its own inability to understand this plant. You can tell too that there was another experiment by Dr. Warmke. You know, he was a government scientist who was featured in Science magazine in 1943, and he was doing some kind of weird experiment where he tried to crossbreed hemp plants that supposedly wouldn't produce marijuana. Now, we know that hemp plants don't produce marijuana at all, but he was doing this weird thing where he would make an extract of these plants that were quote unquote marijuana plants and of different varieties of potency. And he would take the extract and put it into a little, like a test tube or a beaker type thing, and had minnows in there. Apparently, and I couldn't really establish the Warmke's scientific basis for this or the precedent for this, but apparently minnows are susceptible to high THC, high concentrations of THC, and they will die if they're exposed to them in water, which I mean, it's really hard to verify that, but I know that there has been no experiment like that moving forward to the present. But he basically put these varying cannabis extracts of varying potency into different beakers with minnows. And the ones where the minnows didn't die, he would crossbreed those plants and try to basically breed out the THC producing genes in those plants so that they could have quote unquote rope without dope. So there you go. That's kind of the manifestation, the scientific manifestation of this conflation of hemp and marijuana.
And your book actually goes through a couple of examples throughout the 20th century where the federal government makes these forays into cannabis agriculture. In fact, you say early in the book, you say the history of marijuana in the United States should be seen as nothing if not the history of a crop. I want you to expand on that a little bit. That sort of stuck with me having read it. What did you mean by that?
Well, I think in terms of actual historical experience, it's been treated as a crop before. You know, that was one of the goals of this book, was to kind of show that, you know, starting with the 1915 edition of Farmer's Bulletin 663. Farmer's Bulletin was a pamphlet that the U.S. Department of Agriculture disseminated to farmers that introduced them to the newest scientific methods in agriculture and, you know, had instructions on how to, you know, get better yields and so forth. And in this particular edition, 663 was titled Drug Plants Under Cultivation, and it included instructions on how to cultivate dozens of drug plants, not only what we would call today marijuana, but ginseng, lavender, even something as weird as like dandelions, you know, had an entry. So there was all these medicinal plants that the U.S. government wanted to see if there was a viable market for American farmers to tap into. at the time. And this was the first official instructions circulated by the government on how to grow drug cannabis. And then it was later updated to include the tidbit that you need to remove all the male plants from the crop. Otherwise, you know, they'll pollinate and the drug product won't be as potent at the end. So centimilla is that's what it's called, comes from the Spanish name for without seeds. But that is commonly attributed to the counterculture, you know, experimenting and breeding and, you know, in Northern California. And then they figured it out, you know. Well, no, the U.S. government figured it out in 1920, you know, and they were circulating instructions on how to grow this stuff as early as 1915. So it kind of smashes the notion that the federal government has just always, always, always been against marijuana or cannabis. The typical example that a lot of the cannabis advocates like to bring up is the example of hemp, which has gotten distorted and all of that. And it's kind of taken on a life of its own with all these conspiracy theories about, you know, why cannabis was made illegal. A lot of advocates point to the hemp industry as kind of this historical presence of cannabis in America, but really drug cannabis has a long history too.
You know, later on you evoke this J.B. Jackson's conception of the vernacular landscape versus the political landscape. Mm-hmm. I feel like it's a really useful lens for this story of cannabis that you're trying to tell. First, can you remind listeners what the vernacular and political landscape is, and then also why you found them useful?
Yeah, so the vernacular landscape is a concept I was introduced to at Colorado State via Mark Fiji, who told me that, you know, I guess every few years their department goes through a J.B. Jackson revival, as he called it, where people start paying attention to him again and his ideas, have renewed merit or something. Yeah, I found it very compelling and I just found it as a really interesting way to look at the landscape. And essentially, the idea of the vernacular landscape is that there is an official or political landscape that the government maintains. Or that the nation, you know, the nation maintains, the state probably is a better word. And that includes things like roads, includes things like public plazas. It includes anything that, you know, courthouses, anything that the government would fund that is for, you know, public use or public consumption, those kinds of buildings, you know, libraries. And this also includes, you know, regulated subdivisions, for instance, you know, like. But then there's also the vernacular landscape laid over that. And that is basically all of the spaces in between the official landscape where people modify the land for their own benefit or their own personal use. And it may not be according to laws. For instance, if someone plants a patch of marijuana in their personal garden, that is part of the vernacular landscape. Gardens themselves are part of the vernacular landscape. You know, people choosing which plants to put, as opposed to, for instance, the manicured lawn of a courthouse or something, or a state capitol building, which was carefully coordinated and planned by government. It does make for a very, very useful lens to understand how cannabis fit into the American landscape. And especially in the West, when you have it proliferating amongst political landscapes like farming, like big ag, sugar beet farms that are plotted according to where federal irrigation projects, you know, were built. But then in the midst of these sugar beet rows, you have workers planting, you know, cannabis. The space in between the rows is the vernacular landscape. The neatly organized rows of sugar beets planted by a private company with the help of, you know, I mean, maybe a government subsidy or something like that. That is the official landscape. I hope that makes it clear.
Yeah, it's a beautiful metaphor. Tell, you know, and that was one of the striking things from your book is that discovery of the spatial overlap between beet farming in the early 20th century and cannabis busts. Tell us a little more about that.
I stumbled upon that completely by accident. You know, I just wanted to find out where people were growing cannabis throughout the 20th century, really at any time, really in the country. This is part of my early research when I was working on my thesis. And the more newspaper articles and reports I found, the more this just trend seemed to be emerging. It was sugar beet workers in sugar beet fields. It was a shack behind a sugar beet field. So it just one after the other kept rolling in. And then when I started plotting them on Google Maps, you know, I just was like, well, this is interesting. I think this is really cool. And it'd be really nice if I could get some kind of comparison. And then through my work with the Colorado Encyclopedia, I was aware of the online archive of the U.S. Department of Agriculture's census records. And I just pulled up the map of sugar beet farms just to see what was up. And then there ended up being this beautiful, I mean, it was just kind of this weird coincidence, but it was just this beautiful overlay. And it expressed the point that I was trying to make in the book, you know, so clearly. It was just kind of really just fortunate to find that. And, you know, then you start going into all of the lived experiences of these people and starting to understand, you know, why sugar beet laborers would turn to this sort of activity. And then, of course, it just gets more fascinating from there.
So what does that tell us about who was using cannabis in the early 20th century and who was growing it?
It's kind of just another chapter in the global history of cannabis traveling the world by attaching itself to laboring underclasses, as Chris Duval put it in his wonderful book, Cannabis, that came out a few years ago. And really, it was a population of Mexican and Mexican-American laborers who, for a variety of reasons, you know, the Mexican Revolution started to unfold around 1910. Before that, you had a dictatorship in Mexico that resulted in a lot of poor farmers losing their land. They needed to find some stability, some work. And then when the revolution breaks out, you have more people fleeing Mexico, just looking for kind of security or work. And then while that was happening, you had a massive expansion of irrigation infrastructure in the American West, a lot of it courtesy of the Federal Bureau of Reclamation. And so it sets up this environment where we have these large, just huge, it's a huge agricultural industry in the West that's just kind of getting going, you know, with this newfound access to water, and it needs a huge labor force. Then the Spanish-American War comes along in that same time period and cuts off the supply of foreign sugar, and the sugar beet takes off as a crop. You know, American farmers start figuring out how to process it, how to get the sugar out of the beets, and it becomes the number one cash crop in the American West. And for a while, farmers went through kind of wave after wave of poor, you know, transient immigrant groups. There was the Chinese, there was the Filipinos, there was Germans from Russia, who had particularly strong background in cultivating sugar beets. But these, a lot of these people were able to kind of transition out of that grunt labor force and become farm owners or tenants themselves. And in comes, you know, this next population, the Mexican-American population that fits, you know, again, they have experience with agricultural labor, they know the sugar beet, you know, they know these crops, so they are able to basically take over the stoop labor of farming beets. Cultivating sugar beets is very, very, very labor intensive. Yeah, there's a lot of stooping, there's a lot of hoeing, there's a lot of bending and picking, and it's hard on the body. And you know, a small segment of these Mexican American workers, you know, from their homeland had knowledge of cannabis as a remedial substance, or even as a recreational substance. They knew how to grow it, so they just planted it and sold it to each other. You know, some of them used it to ease the pains from a day's worth of labor. Some of them used it to kind of take their minds off of the work while they were doing it. Others used it recreationally. And then, of course, the money was a big part of that as well. You know, selling it to your fellow beet workers could supplement some of the meager wages you got out in the fields. And then, of course, selling it to the broader American public, you know, once they started catching on, you know, in the 1920s. That also became a lucrative market for these folks. By the 1940s, some of these workers are raking in, you know, tens of thousands of dollars in this stuff. And it's just something, it's an opportunity they just would not have anywhere else in American society.
Are there estimates of how many people were using marijuana back in the 20s and 30s?
No, there are really no reliable estimates of that. There's no reliable estimates of the crop. There's no reliable data for any of that. I mean, a lot of what I kind of put together in the book was just based off of, you know, I tried to squeeze as much factual information out of these newspaper reports as possible. And it's not always straightforward, but, you know, there are certain things that the press doesn't really have a good reason to lie about, you know, for instance, or to spin, you know, for instance, where a crop was found, you know, who was growing it. You know, they really never get into the whole why. You know, that's up to the historian to kind of figure out, put context around it and figure out why people might make that decision. Once you understand that they did not get paid very well, it was seasonal work, it was backbreaking work, the plant had value to them from what they knew of it back in their homeland. You put all those things together, and it's just kind of a natural choice for people who's kind of struggling at the bottom of that socioeconomic ladder.
And that's one of another interesting edge that you explore in this book, is the ways that cannabis comes from Mexico with migrant laborers and then transitions into this kind of drug of choice for white middle class, upper middle class Americans. And the ways that the right culture describes those two things is very different. Tell us a little more about that.
The context surrounding the Marijuana Tax Act, the first law that prohibited cannabis nationwide, was that the herb was mostly consumed by lower class Latinos, black jazz musicians. That was more of a Southern and East Coast phenomenon with the jazz scene there, but it also, you know, permeated the West as well. And there was the whole, the influx of Mexican-American laborers. This was a group of people that most white Americans had no problem throwing into jail for drug use or for drug-related crimes. In fact, the media did such a good job at tying marijuana exclusively to Latinos and blacks in, you know, the early 20th century, despite the fact that a lot of their clients were, in fact, white American. They came to be seen as, you know, a problem population. And it was exactly like the Chinese, you know, being criminalized via the opium laws. You know, they were the first kind of minority to be persecuted by drug laws. So that was kind of the racial context or the ideas that were going on there. Persisted for a couple decades until the 1960s and the counterculture comes to the fore. The beatnik generation of the 50s did a lot of work popularizing marijuana amongst kind of the bohemian, artist, white, middle class population. And then the 60s hippie movement, counterculture movement, really took that to the next level and really popularized the drug amongst middle class young white people. And what happened was they started getting arrested and being thrown in jail, and their parents were not too pleased by it. And even the white society felt almost bad about it, you know, and then there was this whole movement to decriminalize, you know, which culminated in the 70s. But the basic fact is that white Americans had no problem locking blacks and Latinos up for using marijuana. But when middle-class white youngsters started to get a hold of it, they were portrayed as innocent kids who really didn't know what they were doing. Should they be punished for the rest of their life for, you know, just one mistake? You know, by all means, lock away the black dealers who sold it to the kid. So that was the kind of mentality. And this is actually documented in a wonderful article, Impossible Criminals by Matt Lassiter, I believe his name is. And that was the perspective. And it's something that continues through today, you know, the disproportionate harassment by authorities of, you know, drug using minority populations versus white populations. You know, today, whites, blacks, Latinos all use marijuana at similar rates. Yet if you're a black person, you're four times more likely to be arrested for a cannabis crime. If you're Latino, you're twice as likely as a white person to be arrested for a cannabis crime. So,
and you mentioned in the book that that's actually still a problem in states that have legalized it.
Yeah, in particular in Colorado, there was a report that found that in terms of underage arrests for cannabis, black, white, and Latino teenagers use cannabis at the same rates. You know, it's the same kind of disparity there. And they found that even though it's legal in Colorado, of course, it's not legal for anyone under 21 to have it. But within that underage possession enforcement metric, you have discriminatory enforcement. And that's just a product of the American policing system at large, right? I mean, it's not just about drugs, but that has been a historically one way for the state to kind of manage or control these populations that it deems inherently dangerous simply because of their background, their ethnicity.
Historically and contemporarily, the state treats people of different ethnicities, socioeconomic backgrounds differently depending on the drug. But you also talk quite a bit about the ways that the vernacular cannabis is described differently in the press depending on who's using it. Can you talk about historically the ways that the press talked about Mexican immigrants in particular using the drug and what the drug did to them?
A great example of this comes from Arizona, which obviously has a long stretch of border with Mexico. Right around the turn of the 20th century there was some Mexican prisoners at a prison in Yuma, Arizona. They were found to be in possession of quote-unquote marijuana. When they were caught with it, the law officer actually returned he put a call out for the local pharmacist to come and retrieve it. So that was really interesting to me, because A, he assumed that it wasn't, you know, the prisoner's weed to begin with, and B, that there was actually like a pharmacist that would come and claim it as his. And then, you know, I started looking up other reports of elsewhere in Arizona and elsewhere in the country where the same exact substance, marijuana, was called cannabis indica, and it was heralded as this great remedy for corns, even for things like asthma and tuberculosis. And it was very much in the interest of professional medicine and pharmacology. And there was all these advertisements from all these companies who imported the drug from England via India at the time, and they would call it cannabis indica or Indian hemp. Those are the two most common terms for it. But then when Mexicans had it, it was the debilitating and mind-altering, psychosis-inducing marijuana, you know, the devil weed.
Do you think that still happens today, the way that pot is represented in our culture? Do you think that those differences in the ways that the press and the media talk about cannabis use among different cultures still persists today?
I think so. And I think one of the big examples of it is the drug Marinol, the prescription drug Marinol, which is an extract of just pure THC. And it was developed in the 70s. And it was basically to answer the, oh, well, marijuana is a medicine, you know, all that stuff. It was the official response to that. It was, okay, well, if something's a medicine, you know, if it's truly a medicine, we should be able to get it into a pill, basically, is how the American, you know, pharmaceutical industry approaches it. And they want to extract, you know, only the active ingredient. So it's okay for someone to be prescribed Marinol, but it's not okay for someone to be using marijuana for medicinal purposes in its whole form, in its plant form. And that's something that really gets at the class aspect of it, because let's say, you know, Marinol is not a very effective medicine, but let's say someone, you would like to use a cannabis-based medicine for pain or something, you know, if they have insurance, they can be prescribed Marinol. It's that simple. If they don't, then, you know, they're going to have to go and, you know, use the real thing, you know, smoke weed. But yet it seems like constantly in the media and the federal government and pharmaceutical companies' eyes that this pure extracted CBD or this pure extracted THC here in this Marinol pill, this is okay. But you who smoke the plant to get the same exact, you know, effect, that is criminal. That's, you know, going to mess up your brain. And so there is still that divide, and it's more of a conceptual divide now between like the whole plant and its extracts. But certainly there's that idea of one use of the plant by a certain group of people is okay, and another use of it by another group is not. So we still have that. You know, and it works with different drugs too. You know, you can go back to the 1980s, you know, when crack, you know, was labeled the scourge of the cities. And yet people on Wall Street are doing cocaine all day. Yet it's the crack communities that get the police raids and, you know, get brutalized, you know, by the enforcement. But, you know, if a white collar executive on Wall Street gets popped with cocaine, he may go to jail. You know, he might. So it kind of works that way with other substances too.
Yeah, it's sort of interesting the way that because we're able to conceptualize of plants in different ways like that, the state is able to exert power differentially based on those different interpretations. So I'm going to fast forward a little bit. There's a great history in your book on different federal policies, maybe not that different, but certainly different approaches as laws are passed and then struck down by the courts and things like that. But I want to fast forward to today, when you point out cannabis is straddling one of the most interesting boundaries that we could be facing both as a state and a nation, which is that states are being asked to craft legislation for something that's still federally illegal. Quickly, who's getting it right and who isn't getting it right in the West through legalization and legislation?
From my perspective, which was, you know, I always kind of wanted to pursue the environmental angle and kind of bring that to the fore. I think if you look at a state like Oregon and California, they, from that standpoint, from an environmental perspective, they were the only two states in this recent wave of legalization that paid explicit attention to the environmental impact of cannabis cultivation.
And what are those impacts? Sorry to interrupt. Tell us a little about that.
That's great. Yeah. When you have unregulated cannabis cultivation, you know, in a place like Northern California is the best example. This is where we're really seeing the effects of this being borne out, the tragic effects, I might add. So you have in California since 1996, medical marijuana has been illegal, but they really haven't regulated the supply side of it. So that just created this gray market situation where people move to Northern California because the laws are lax and there's really no regulation on, you know, growing or anything like that. Plus it's a remote area where, you know, enforcement is basically impossible anyway, with a reputation for, you know, the world's finest weed, et cetera, et cetera. So brings in people from all over the world, all over the country, growing illegal marijuana out there. Okay. They clear cut the forest. They will drive heavy machinery up these old dirt logging roads, which sloughs off a bunch of sediment into the rivers and clogs up habitat for salmon and the like. They use rodenticide pellets around their crop, which are consumed by other small mammals, and then, you know, eventually go up the food chain and kill larger animals like the California fisher. There's also just immense heaps of trash left behind these outdoor growing sites, you know, everything from fertilizer bags to plastic bottles filled with, you know, noxious chemicals to just standard, you know, camp related trash, you know, like food bags and whatnot. So all of this cumulatively has the effect of severely degrading an ecosystem outdoors. Now that's outdoors. Indoor cultivation uses a ton of energy to power all of these grow lights, AC units, fans, you know, everything to keep the plants growing and cool and all of that. There was one study from 2011 from California, again, that estimated that the indoor cannabis crop there used about 3% of the whole state's electricity. Now that more states are coming online, states like Colorado really didn't pay attention to, at the beginning, about how cannabis was produced. You know, they kind of just let the dominant model that had been developed in Prohibition continue. And so you have Denver growers moving into giant warehouses, hanging lights, paying $30,000 a month in electricity bills, while also, you know, increasing the carbon footprint of the cannabis crop. So these are all the environmental impacts of that. Now, Oregon had a special commission right after they legalized put together to study the environmental impacts of the crop and recommend best practices based on the experiences of states like Colorado and its neighbor, Washington. So they really had, from day one, a working set of best practices that they wanted to enforce throughout the industry. And then California actually has the strictest environmental regulations, particularly when it comes to water use, because the other thing with the outdoor growers is that they just kind of divert whatever stream is convenient for water. One or two, okay, fine. But with the level of cultivation that's going on up there, it has a cumulative impact on the water system. So California is requiring that every cannabis grower disclose the source of their water, make sure that it is a legal right, and so forth. So those two states, because I think they have the benefit of looking at states like Colorado and Washington that legalized earlier and seeing maybe what they missed or overlooked, as well as their own unique challenges in their state. As I said, California being the best example. Colorado didn't have to regulate 50,000 growers. They just didn't have, there wasn't that many, you know, and California's faced with this incredible, nearly impossible, I would say, task of wrapping its arm around tens of thousands of growers who aren't registered in any way. Those are two states that, you know, they're trying from the outset to do it. But you can set up all of the laws and regulations you want, but it doesn't guarantee, of course, that you can enforce them or that growers will be willing to comply, especially with it still being federally illegal to grow cannabis. There's a lot of skepticism, especially on some of the more remote growers, you know, in the Emerald Triangle in California. They don't want to participate in any regulation. They just don't want it. They don't want their names to be anywhere on a document where the federal government can get its hands on it and get to them eventually. So there is a lot of challenges at the state level, but I would say that Oregon, California are among the strictest as far as environmental regulations. And the black market situation is another issue, and, you know, we can touch on that later.
Yeah, actually, let me follow up on that now. The thing that interests me so much about cannabis is that, to me, it almost exposes like a third landscape that Jackson missed, which is the economic landscape, right? There's like the vernacular and the political, like what the state would like to see. But beyond that, there's just the money involved, you know? And as much as the state can try to regulate pot up here in Northern California, if it's above a certain price, people are going to grow it however they want to grow it, right? Avoiding all of the regulations. So say a little more, can you tell us about the economics of weed and how that plays into whether states are going to be able to regulate it effectively?
Absolutely. I would say right now there is zero chance that California will regulate marijuana effectively as long as the price is above $500 per pound is the number that I got from an environmentalist out there on the North Coast. He thinks that if you can drive the price down below that, it won't be worth it to go out and grow it illegally You're right. It absolutely does come down to price. There's a huge black market still in marijuana, and states like California and Colorado that have legalized are supplying that black market. And really the only way to smash it, to drive the price down, is to have federal regulation. So for instance, you know, states like Nebraska and Oklahoma, who sued Colorado over its cannabis law because they didn't want to deal with, you know, the pot coming across the borders. It's like, well, you know, this is something that is going to happen. People smoke weed everywhere. They're not going to stop. They're not going to stop growing it. You have to de-incentivize it somehow. You have to, and really the main way to do that is by attacking it at the price level. We can connect, just really briefly, we can connect that price, the economic landscape, to the actual landscape, to the environment, where like literally the fate of the coho salmon depends on the federal government's ability to smash the black market, you know, in cannabis.
Do you think that, I mean, there's obviously a lot of frustration around the federal government's disinterest in legalization. Do you think that there are benefits to having a few states go first before the feds figure out their approach to legalization?
I think so, yeah. And I think any state that wants to do experiments, radical policy experiments like this, as long as they're, you know, well informed, I think it's definitely within their rights. And I think it ultimately will make for a better federal experience, just because the people that are involved in the industry now, the way it is, the landscape of the cannabis growing community, it's still small scale. Still talking about like mostly people who've been doing this for decades, you know, underground. And they're just now getting, you know, legitimate, and they're really interested in things like water recycling and more efficient lighting technology and moving into greenhouses. They're really interested in making their industry sustainable, and only legalization has the ability to do that. So those kinds of people are going to be basically pioneering the model of the cannabis industry in these states that hopefully will then translate to federal regulation. So hopefully federal legalization will be informed by the experiences in the states, because it's very instructive, especially in the, you know, in the arid West, you know, where you're dealing with water shortages and these kind of things. And I'm an advocate for breaking up the national like footprint of cannabis cultivation, of getting that away from places like California and Oregon that, you know, it's like if you go to the grocery store in New York and you buy California almonds, you're buying almonds, but you're also buying water from California. And if you do that with weed in New York, you're buying California water, yeah, there too. The Hudson Valley could easily produce boatloads of marijuana. So yeah, just let them. And let's save the water resources in the West.
Chapter 6 sort of captures a very different spirit in Denver in particular of a rapidly growing industry and of consolidation.
Sure.
And in fact, you talk a lot about the technology. Mm-hmm. So can you say a little more about how technology and growing weed has changed over the past few decades and what that consolidation looks like?
The first report of anyone growing cannabis indoors actually comes from the 1950s in California, where a teenager actually was doing it in his basement with a little lamp. Now, in the 1950s, halide light technology had not been perfected yet. It wasn't, you know, widely available, and it didn't start becoming widely available until really the late 60s, early 70s, which is convenient for the counterculture, was popularizing cannabis at the time. And then, of course, with the crackdown of the Reagan administration in the 80s. By that time, halide light technology was actually very advanced. And, you know, you could get these lights at any kind of garden supply shop. That's where you kind of see this interesting intersection between the garden supply industry and the underground cannabis industry, because, you know, the garden supply people were happy to have this new customer base, you know, right? It did more money for them, as long as they didn't explicitly participate and say, hey, yes, I will sell you these lights for growing marijuana, the illegal, you know, substance. How do you know? You could legitimately say that you were going to grow tomatoes or something inside. So that kind of the advent of halide light technology is extremely important. And then, of course, you know, the wide availability of electricity, you know, with cheap fossil fuel resources, you know, all of that, as much as it fueled the expansion of big ag and transformations in that industry, it also fueled transformations in the underground agricultural pursuit of marijuana farming. So nowadays, you know, if we fast forward, LED lights are kind of the new thing, and they're also being developed at a rapid pace since legalization because companies feel more secure in developing these because, you know, it's legal now. And also cannabis growers are more open to searching out these kinds of more efficient lighting technologies and all that. But at the same time, you know, we're seeing a gradual transition now from indoor to outdoor growing, whether that's straight outdoors or in greenhouses, because the greenhouse industry is now picking up in the wake of legalization. So it's this weird thing where, like, of course, technology transformed the underground industry, but now that it's legal, the legalization of this industry is transforming technology. And, you know, it's just kind of going to go back into that reciprocal cycle.
And what about the consolidation? It sounds like there's a lot of economic interest in Denver in consolidation, for lack of a better word. Like, what does that look like on the ground out there?
Out in Denver, it is accurate. There are warehouses that, like I said, they pay, you know, 50 grand a month in electricity to power these massive grow facilities, you know, thousands of square feet. That's probably going to be more of a temporary thing because it's just becoming more practical and, of course, a lot cheaper to grow it outside. So right now you're seeing this consolidation. And are there going to be large greenhouse firms? Yes. I actually just interviewed a law professor at Concordia University. His name is Ryan Stoa. And he's taken a look at this from a legal perspective. And there's this whole idea among not only cannabis advocates, but also opponents who are talking about big marijuana is going to come take over the industry. And there's going to be all these giant factory farms and they're going to price out the mom and pop side. And they're going to, you know, that's what the cannabis advocates say. And then the opponents say these giant drug farms are going to be plying your children with drugs. So from both sides, this idea of big marijuana has proved very captivating. But this this Professor Stoa is saying, listen, there's hundreds and hundreds of varieties of cannabis. That was one of the benefits of prohibition for the cannabis plant, was that each grower kind of had this clandestine, you know, experiments with breeding and, you know, coming up with their own strains. And it was so underground for so long that everyone kind of only developed their own unique strains and their own unique varieties. And it was all developed in these little pockets, right, of breeding. And now that it's legal and dispensaries are carrying all of these, you know, wacky named strains, you know, like Trainwreck and OG Kush and Skywalker, you know, these things. According to the law, you can't patent these strains because they're already out there in the public in circulation. So if a company wants to say, well, I'm going to grow 1,000 acres of sour diesel and I'm going to patent it so that no one else can produce this, you know, they can't do that. So that's kind of one obstacle to this big marijuana thing. And the other thing is that in Colorado is a good example. We have a craft brewing industry that survives alongside Budweiser, sometimes in the same town, right? Fort Collins is known as a craft brewing town, but there's a huge Budweiser plant there. What's to say that the same thing can't happen with marijuana? You know, there are options. One of the things that this Professor Stowe was suggesting was follow the model of the wine industry. Use the appellation system, which is essentially a system that assigns a point of geographic origin for an agricultural product and has a set of standards associated with that, to where you can't say, oh, I grew this stuff in my basement in Arkansas and it's as good as Humboldt County weed. If you had under the Appalachian system, Humboldt County, we would be protected. And that would be one way of kind of ensuring that small scale farmers and producers could remain viable in a market with large producers. Because there's always going to be demand for just bulk cannabis to make extracts or to make, you know, cookies or something. But there's also going to be that craft niche. And that was one of the things that I found when I was talking with Denver Relief, you know, one of the oldest running dispensaries in Denver, is they were that niche. They fit that niche. Now, the local economic conditions and the way the industry was developing there prohibited them from remaining in that niche. But that's not to say that given different regulations and the progress of legalization, that it can't be regulated a different way, right?
Yeah. Do you think that can happen at the state level? I mean, that was one of the big criticisms locally, coming to you from Humboldt County, of the referendum. And In 2016, one of the big criticisms here was this idea that it was just going to allow for really big ag to come in and ruin the local cannabis culture and economy. Do you think that the state level is capable of implementing that kind of legislation, or do you think it would have to fall to the federal government?
Well, again, I'm going to go to my source, Mr. Ryan Stoa, because he's already looked into this. And there was a previous version of the act that passed passed in California, and it authorized a state agency to create a system of appellations or enforce designations of origin. So now how that works with other states that it's where it's not legal, again, you know, without a uniform system that is backed up by the federal government, it's really hard to tell how effective that would be, but states can do it. They can try.
You set out to write the history of cannabis as a crop. What do you think makes cannabis similar to other crops in the West, and what makes it different?
In terms of just physical requirements, it's very similar to corn. In terms of just what, I mean, it'll just take as much water and nutrients as you want to throw at it. It really is a singular crop. In terms of the dimensions of its use, I mean, whether you're planting a field of hemp, or a field of drug cannabis. I mean, marijuana can be used for everything to, you know, help someone just unwind from a stressful day to actually really improving someone who has AIDS, improving their life on a daily basis. And there are different strains of the plant that can be grown to enhance either experience. I really don't know of any other crop that does that. I mean, its closest relative botanically in the West would be hops, which is cultivated across, you know, wide swaths of the Pacific Northwest. Like cannabis, hops are grown to be included in an intoxicating substance, right? And there's a whole wide-ranging palette of hops, you know, that can have some that are more bitter, some that are more fruity, some that are piney, and all of that. Those are very similar chemicals, by the way, as to what actually makes weed smell the way it does, terpenes. Hops cannot really make someone, you know, it can't be this enjoyable substance on the one hand and then be like purely medicinal on the other. Really, cannabis is this plant that just, you talk about boundaries, I mean, it kind of collapses all of the boundaries for all of these different plants that we're used to and into one cryptic plant. And that's what is continually fascinating for me, is the singularity of cannabis. Now, I think there's a danger there because it's just a singular plant, we tend to focus on it out of context of agriculture, of other plants. And that is where what we should not do. If we're going to look at the water requirements of a pot plant, for instance, you know, that's a hot topic now. How much water does cannabis use? You have to put it in comparison with other crops. And, you know, and in fact, I've done that, and it ranks somewhere, you know, between like lettuce and peaches. In comparison, you have all these articles saying that, oh my gosh, all these cannabis plants are using so much water, 6 gallons a day. Oh my God. Oh, it's so much. Well, did anybody in that story really think about other crops are using water? I mean, this is why I wanted to write this book and put it back in the agricultural sphere so that we can have these conversations, putting it back within the context of agriculture, which is where it should be discussed and should be the starting point for all regulations.
Yeah. So one final duality, as you mentioned, a lot of people smoke pot. Cannabis is pretty ubiquitous in the United States, and yet it's really hard to come by hard facts and data. Are there things that writing this book you wish you could have known more about to tell this history of cannabis in the West?
Yeah, I mean, I wish I had a little bit more information on who was growing it and where and why. I think I came across hundreds of newspaper articles about it, but very few of those articles mentioned people growing it at all. I think if I could go back and direct newspapers in the Southwest to like ask this guy who was arrested for weed, you know, why are you growing it? And you know, what about, you know, the environment here, you know, allows, you know, obviously this would never happen. But I think, you know, if I had just more on who was growing it and where and why, it would make for a much more complete picture. And I think that now we have a great deal more data available on that, you know, and the stories that come out are just, are just fascinating. You know, people who cultivate a certain strain that works for a particular affliction. From that, you go from that to the guy who's growing hemp to, you know, build cars out of, you know, to make hempcrete. The versatility of the plant is what has ensured its millennia old relationship with humans. It's what's ensured its survival as a species that really would just kind of go extinct if it was in the wild. You don't see a lot of wild cannabis around. You know, the cannabis that you do see, I mean, it's a hardy plant, but it's really attached itself to humanity because of its usefulness. And it's really, really gotten a whole lot of benefits. It has the widest geographic range of any crop. It really has conquered the world, and it's all owing to its versatility, to its kind of cryptic nature that just kind of allows us to keep, you know, peeling back layers of what it's good for, you know, and all kinds of its uses over time. I'm always fascinated by these plants that travel, you know, the globe, but this is by far the most fascinating one. You know, it thrives in open landscapes. You know, where do you see an open landscape in nature? You know, it's not something that just happens. You know, there's meadows and all those things, but those have been colonized by plants that are frankly a lot better at fitting that niche than cannabis is, you know, but cannabis fits the human niche. I think that's what you can say.
Great. Well, Nick Johnson, thank you very much. Your new book, Grassroots, A History of Cannabis in the American West, I think does a really great job filling in some of those rows between the crops, telling the story of a plant that is ubiquitous and yet poorly understood. So I really appreciate you joining EdgeFX today.
Great. Thanks a lot, Tim. Happy to be here.
That was Tim Bean, assistant professor in the Department of Wildlife at Humboldt State University, speaking with historian Nick Johnson, author of Grassroots, A History of Cannabis in the American West, available now from Oregon State University Press. You can learn more about Nick Johnson's work at hempiricalevidence.com or follow him on Twitter at TheHempiricist. You've been listening to EdgeFX, a production of CHE, the Center for Culture, History, and Environment in the Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Today's episode was produced by Tim Bean, Brian Hamilton, and me, Charles Carlin, with special thanks to Marty Brown. The music you're hearing is by Julian Lynch. We'll be back in 2 weeks with a conversation rethinking Henry David Thoreau with Laura Dasso Walls and Dagan Miller. You can get all of our episodes sent straight to your computer or mobile device by subscribing to the EdgeFX podcast in Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher, or TuneIn. If you like the show, please leave us a rating and a review. That really helps connect us to new listeners. You can also follow us on Twitter at EdgeFXMag. And, as always, keep up with the steady flow of great content about cultural and environmental change across the full sweep of human history at edgefx.net.